Atlas Shrugged. In honor of today's DVD release of Atlas Shrugged Part 2, what's your favorite ill-conceived message movie?
I'm Katie Rich, and I continue to love Avatar, and mostly because it reaffirms my pink commie liberal lefty environmental ideals.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I'm partial to the Left Behind series because it both sticks to its ridiculous elements while simultaneously starring the very real Kirk Cameron.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with The Little Mermaid, because no matter how many feminist rants I hear about the 80s Disney movies being pro-marriage and anti-women, I'll still enjoy that movie on a musical level.
I'm David Ehrlich, and I want to go with Triumph of the Will, or any, you know, there's so many possible answers here, but I think in the spirit of the Oscar season, I'll stick with Silver Linings Playbook, which says, spoiler alert, just gamble until you win and your family will be saved.
There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
This week on Operation Kino, episode 102 for Tuesday, February 19th, 2013, we are talking about The Amazing Spider-Man and Spotify. We have a pop culture existential crisis, and we get into a conversation about whether or not the Oscars even matter.
In my own heart, I just want to believe that
this
nobody
is Spider-Man 3.
Right, that nobody would make that mistake again. It just feels like they're getting people in place and putting these little placeholders on them, saying, we're going to use you eventually, and we'd love to cast properly, and so let's start locking people up long-term.
All right, this week I decided to bring in Sean O'Connell from Cinema Blend to talk Spider-Man with me, and we also have Matt Patches, because Sean has a very interesting theory about Mark Webb's casting. I would say this came right after Mark Webb cast the Rhino in the form of Paul Giamatti, and everybody was sort of wondering if we were going to get a Spider-Man 3 villain overload. And Sean wrote an article that basically said that Mark Webb is actually sort of building a Spider-Man universe, and we shouldn't look for that overload. Am I characterizing that correctly, Sean?
That's pretty much it. Yeah, I think that's what started forming it. And I guess in my own heart, I just want to believe that
this
nobody
isn't Spider-Man 3.
Right, that nobody would make that mistake again, and that Sony would be pretty cognizant of, hey, we're not going to overload it with villains. And so when they start casting people of the ilk of Paul Giamatti and Jamie Foxx, and you know, they start looking to other villains, because we still have to figure out who is that person in the room at the end, you know, over the end credits too. And I think that's going to hint towards some more building, and we still have to add Norman Osborn. And, you know, there's all these other hints in the genetic tree in Oscorp that it just feels like they're getting people in place and putting these little placeholders on them, saying, we're going to use you eventually, and we'd love to cast, you know, properly, and so let's start locking people up long term, because it seems like these superhero franchises now, they're not thinking just let's get through a trilogy and get out, and if we get three films we're successful. You know, the Avengers changed the game, and now everybody's sort of thinking long term and maybe trying to go five pictures, six pictures if they can. And so that it just felt like that's what Mark Webb was trying to do, and really it was a shot in the dark, a total spitball, the column. I mean, I believe a lot of it, but I don't have anything to really back it up. And it was just when Mark Webb retweeted it, I just sort of felt like, all right, I don't know what I got right in there, but I feel like I got something right, because if it was completely way off base, he just would have ignored it.
Or yeah. Maybe he's just laughing in the background, like, spend your time guessing what I'm doing. You'll never know.
He could waste days doing that, though.
Although, to be fair, you know, I interviewed Avi Arad and Matt Tolmach, who produced The Amazing Spider-Man back during the first movie, and they were, I mean, my whole thing was getting this kind of scoop from them that was, we want to build a bigger universe. We thought, I mean, the Avengers is the right way to do it, and we have to do that.
I think if we look back on the coverage of the first movie, you'll find that interview done by all three of us, if I'm not mistaken. But they definitely did seem like they were sort of building a world out. I guess I'm just surprised at how, I guess the interesting thing that Sean's article made me think about was beyond a trilogy, because I was still in the mindset that they were, you know, building up this Mark Webb trilogy as opposed to the Sam Raimi trilogy, and then they were going to, you know, maybe do it all over again. I'm really excited by the prospect that maybe we've gotten out of the origin story rut from a superhero, which I've been historically thinking that that's kind of talking down to audiences with some characters. And especially, I know we have some divisive opinions here from The Amazing Spider-Man, because I know Patches was not that much into it. I didn't mind it. Sean loved it. So we sort of follow the gamut here. But this one, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the villains, but you also have a new Harry Osborn. And we have Felicity Jones, who's coming on as another sort of younger love interest, as well as Shailene Woodley, who's coming in as Mary Jane. I say love interest just assuming because she's female and of the same age.
But, like, that means there's three females who you would probably characterize as love interests. That seems a little strange.
Well, but it also, like, it serves to back out the Spider-Man universe. Go ahead,
absolutely.
Sean.
Well, just that Elizabeth Banks played Betty Brant, and she never really evolved beyond just J. Jonah's secretary. So, we're sort of putting her into that role, or at least I'm putting her in that role. I don't really know if that's what it is. Some people have said Black Cat, maybe Felicia Hardy. And that could be another placeholder. Like, you could just see her in the background and she could factor in later. I just find it really interesting that, you know, the direction that I thought we were going to go with casting, and maybe I was just being short-sighted, was the Goblin. You know, we started hearing Harry Osborn, and Norman's mentioned in the first one, and so I just assume that we're going to start hearing that name, and we haven't even heard that name mentioned. And so I find that really, really interesting, because they have to get to it eventually. I think that's the villain that they could do over, you know, from the Raimi films, and not really annoy too much the people who love the Raimi films. I think if they did Doc Ock, because Alfred Molina did such a good job with it, it might be offensive. But the way that they set up Oscorp as the backdrop of this, you know, the umbrella over this whole story, they have to mention the Goblin eventually, and they haven't even scratched that surface yet.
Yeah.
But do you think he's even going to appear in this movie? Like, I think he's going to have almost the same role as he did in the first one.
Yeah, I agree with that. And
villains are being assembled.
You know, if they leave him out of it again, then it really makes me think that they're thinking, you know, five pictures, six pictures, because he has to come into it soon enough. And if they don't rush it, I'm kind of happy.
I think that shows a little bit too much confidence. If I were to have my cake of my universe cake, but also my trilogy cake, we would see the Goblin by the end of 2 and build into an unexpected Sinister Six for 3, which is, we know Avi Arad, the producer, has talked about wanting to do for a while now in the Spider-Man universe.
But is Sinister Six like its own movie, like Avengers? To me, Sean, what you're describing here is building Spider-Man up and having these different villains. Like, I was really intrigued by someone on Crave wrote this crazy article based on that one picture of a locker that Mark Webb tweeted from set, right, and had this whole Venom theory. And to me, that actually made a lot of sense, because Matt Tomek and Avi Arad have been talking about doing a Venom spinoff and to introduce Harry Osborn as a possible person to kind of lead that. It's like, yeah, Dane DeHaan is the type of star you would set up and spin off and then maybe reassemble in like an Avengers type movie against Sinister Six, its own picture outside of all brands, kind of unifying Venom and Spider-Man and doing all this gigantic event stuff, but outside of an actual Spider-Man franchise.
Well, I do agree with all that. I think that that's a big, you know, super evil group that could carry his own film and probably should have a little bit more time to develop. I do worry about them rushing it a little bit. And I wonder how much that Venom locker was just a sleight of hand on Mark Webb's part to maybe see how much people are paying attention, maybe just stir the pot a little bit. I find it really interesting that he's tweeting all these different things from the set and giving away clues that could be non-clues. And, you know, we don't really know what to make of most of the stuff that he's posting online. Going back to the first film, though, the more that they keep talking about all of these pieces that felt incomplete, and I mean, I understand what people were complaining about, how they just felt like to shoehorn Peter's origin wrapped around his father's research felt, you know, unfinished or hurried, because you introduce the parents and then you take them out of the equation. If they're going to keep developing Richard Parker's research and the genetic effect that it might have on villains, then it makes me wonder, like, how much did they really know at this first stage of how deep and how far they wanted this theory to go? So I'm really interested to see how it develops into this second film, because I think it's hard to judge the first one until we kind of see what direction they're going with
that. That to me is what points to, if they're going to go big, they're going to go big quicker, because it seems like Amazing Spider-Man 2 financially did okay, with sort of success. critically did okay, but wasn't like the huge success that some of the previous Spider-Mans had been.
Right.
And so do you really look at that movie and are like, we're going to build, you know, seven more films in this world?
Right.
Or do you wait and see if you could pull off this scale as fast as possible? Whether or not I think that's good for the movie or not, that seems to make more business sense to me. But then again, I don't know, because I also think that the first film sort of got monkeyed with a little bit by Sony before it got to the screen.
So do you think who do you think the villain is in Amazing Spider-Man 2 then? Do you think it's just Electro? Do you think we'll see a Rhino?
I think the Rhino is like opening big action scene and then out. I think Paul Giamatti's in it just to get to play Rhino in a movie for 2 seconds.
No kidding, really. And I've always wanted that. I've always believed
that
Spider-Man movie should open with a big action scene, use a villain who wouldn't carry a whole film, but just put him up there for the fans. You know, maybe Vulture or someone like that who you wouldn't want to see an entire feature built around. But I'd hate to see them waste Giamatti in just an opening scene.
Well, I guess we're getting close to my time limit. So as a way of wrapping up, I guess, Sean, what's the most outlandish thing you see for Amazing Spider-Man 3 as this trilogy capper, if you're just shooting for the stars?
For 3?
Yeah.
Gosh, I don't know, because I always like to believe that you have to kill Gwen in 2 and have Peter deal with the repercussions in a third part. So, I mean, I kind of think that we have to see it play out that way. I think Gwen somehow has to die in the second one, and then the third one is redemption.
But do you think they'll do it the way the comics have kind of led us to believe? I mean, it's such a mark in Spider-Man history, but it doesn't seem to be shaping up that way.
No, it doesn't. And I always believed that they would. But since we haven't heard any Norman Osborn casting for 2, then no, I don't believe that anymore. And that was interesting. Somebody said that online and it started this discussion of if another villain, if it was Harry as Venom or someone else like that, if they were the one responsible for killing Gwen and Peter had to go fight Harry as Venom or someone else, would that bother me to have that mythology changed? And for some reason, it wouldn't. And David mentioned that just because, you know, that's such a popular story and it's been told so many different times. I mean, I have to keep an open mind. I have to keep an open mind on what they're trying to do.
Anyway, thank you so much for joining us, Sean.
This was a pleasure. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can find more of Sean at cinemablend.com. And anywhere else, Sean, you want to talk about?
Fandango and movies.com and my Twitter feed, which I love, Sean_O'Connell. And in your hearts and minds everywhere.
Man About Town. Well, I want to have him back as Spider-Man progresses.
But there's just all this stuff that I've been missing out on that I haven't been paying attention to, and I think movies in some way are to blame for it, because I let kind of my engagement with this one single area of art, which is also my job, kind of check off that box for me in my head. I watched the Grammys last Sunday and probably ill-advisedly.
You were the one.
I know, I was the one.
I watched the Grammys last Sunday.
I actually only watched about 45 minutes of the Grammys and saw like 20 things that made me mad. But it was, I mean, the Grammys every year for me are kind of a recognition of how little I understand modern music and how few things I'm listening to. But I kept hearing things that I really liked, or at least, you know, the promise of something that I really liked, like the girl from the Alabama Shakes who sang in the Levon Helm tribute, and then Frank Ocean's terrible performance, which I knew was backed up by a good album. So I started listening to Channel Orange, which I had just downloaded a couple days earlier, and then realized that I was completely disconnected from music entirely. And it was finally time to start paying for Spotify, which I think is the least you can really do. Yeah, I had Spotify, and you can listen to everything on Spotify on your computer with ads, but you can't listen to any of it on the subway, which was really my prime opportunity to listen to any music. And usually I listen to podcasts on the subway, which is, I guess, in some way, research for this show, but a lot of times
cribbing for
this time
show,
on the subway.
I think you mean stealing content.
Yeah, but finding things to steal. But I realized that I wasn't listening to any music anymore. You know, Michael sits in the basement and plays a lot of music, and he's really engaged with music. And I get a lot of that trickles down to me, but not a ton of it, and not anything that I think is more my taste than his. And it was just kind of this terrifying realization that I had let my interest in music completely die. And over the last week or so, since I've gotten Spotify, I've been able to I mean, I'm still learning how to use it. I find it a little bit unnecessarily complicated to figure out how to listen to something offline and when you have something and when you don't, and how to, you know, on the app on your phone, you can only get certain playlists. It's a little bit weird in some ways, but it's all of this music that's right there for you. And it's been this really interesting discovery for me to realize, you know, not only do I still enjoy music like any human with a soul should, but there's just all this stuff that I've been missing out on that I haven't been paying attention to. And I think movies in some way are to blame for it, because I let kind of my engagement with this one single area of art, which is also my job, kind of check off that box for me in my head. And I don't know. I don't know if any of you guys have had this problem. Yes, please.
Do you see it as your job eating your free time, or do you see it as you just enjoy what's your job so much that it's cutting off this other thing that you would like to have more interest in?
Well, it's a combination of the two. And it's not so much that I was like, oh, I'm watching so many movies, I can't listen to music, because that doesn't make any sense. Like, I'm sitting at my computer all day writing, I could easily be listening to music at the same time. But I think I was, you know, saying like, oh, well, I'm engaging in this art form, I'm learning about it, it's interesting, I don't have time to start looking into music to listen to. Like, I'm, like, you know, reading Pitchfork or something, I feel like I don't have time for, in air quotes, because obviously that's not true.
Well, it's a difference between just listening to music and discovering new music and finding something up. Because for me, Spotify, I go to Spotify to listen to something I'm already aware of. Like, I want to, I'm not discovering anything there, unless.
So how do you? Where do you discover things?
Function to kind of spin your tastes into something else. I feel like that's the real way to do it.
No, I've exclusively used Spotify because I'm like Katie in that, like, the idea of using Spotify as my primary means of listening to music doesn't appeal to me, because most of the time that I'm listening to music, I'm on the subway, I'm traveling, I'm walking, I'm not particularly confident in my internet connection, and I want it on my iPod. But I've used Spotify explicitly to discover new music, mostly for exercise and clicking around to stuff that I would never listen to otherwise.
But how do you make that discovery using Spotify? Like, using jumping related, from recommendations? Or
I mean, I just use the related. Yeah, exactly, the recommendations. You can do the same thing on iTunes, but I find that Spotify is a little bit more accurate. And of course, you can listen to the entire song rather than just a sample before you decide to plunk down a dollar for
it. But even for me, like, I'm looking at the recommendations that Spotify gives based on some of the music that I've landed on, and it still feels kind of narrow. Like, I'm jumping to a lot of things that are kind of already on my radar. Well, and I have the same problem with you, Katie, that, like, if I go to Pitchfork or a music blog, you know, I still feel like I'm getting very narrow tastes, and maybe because I'm critical of a lot of bloggers because of the world we come from. And actually, I remember over Christmas this past year, you and I, Katie, met a music blogger who, like, was talking about how Spotify is the worst thing in the world, and he just hated everything. And I'm listening to this music blogger talk about hating everything. I'm like, how am I supposed to find something new if when I go on your website, everything is just, like, dismissed?
But there, and I feel, I think, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head in thinking that it's really about finding a voice that you can trust, that you do want to listen to. It obviously wasn't this particular guy. But I think that one of the reasons that Spotify is less helpful to me in finding music that I actually enjoy and don't just doesn't have like a certain BPM that is helpful when I'm running is that I don't know these voices. I don't know this algorithm that's recommending me to new bands. I don't have any faith in it, and it doesn't really lead to the most engaged exploration. Whereas if you trust a site like Pitchfork, and typically, you know, Pitchfork has a dicey reputation sometimes, but typically the music that they really pour a lot of love on tends to be pretty reliable.
Kind of curious then,
but like,
where,
if you find any site, I mean, really anyone you trust, it's just like movie sites. I mean, you find a voice that you trust and it stands out from this ocean of opinions.
Where do you end up finding that music then? Who are the voices that you trust specifically?
I mean, there are a number of music blogs from Pitchfork and Stereogum and Gorilla vs. Bear and my friends. I mean, I have friends who are musicians.
There we go. Thank you. Someone said friends.
It's not
Jesus
an
Christ.
It's
I don't even use
friend.
Spotify. Don't you guys have
I don't
friends?
Trust,
that
I don't really get many recommendations from friends.
I have friends. I mean, I live with someone who's really passionate about music, but he has a specific taste. It isn't necessarily exactly my taste.
I have two. My tastes are too weird for friends.
I need to, like, find who of my friend, like, likes the group that is Mumford & Sons but better, because that's what I'm looking for. Like, find me that
person. But, like, even beyond that, I feel like you would want to I don't know, dip your toes into something a little more dangerous. Or I've come on this podcast and talked about the wonders of radio before, and I listen to a lot of music radio in the form of podcasts, I guess, or at night. But I get a lot of recommendations of world music and just like random stuff that I would never listen to from people whose job it is to dig that up and play it for me. But like outside, mm-hmm. I still feel like a lot of the websites people direct me to have to engage audiences with what is popular. And it seems like a lot of radio, especially if it's just a few schmoes laying down tracks on their own time, don't have to play that game at all. I started listening to the most recent album I started listening to on Spotify is this guy Avi Avital, and he's an Israeli mandolist who just put out a Bach cover album. Okay, this is not something that I'm going to read about anywhere, and the only reason I found out about it because I listened to a random episode of Soundcheck, which is this WNYC public radio program, and they just that's their job, dig up all this crazy world music. And I love my friends, but my friends are not going to get me to that album.
Well, then, I mean, I think that everything you said is certainly valid and helpful. I think I feel fortunate to know some people who have really adventurous tastes, and it is sort of their jobs, and they make their livelihood on that and sort of sharing in that music. And so it can be really helpful to friends. But I also think
to further
a bit of a controversial notion that the most exotic and sort of exhilarating music that I've encountered has been stolen. You go to these sites that will put up very, very obscure things that you wouldn't be able to name the company that's putting them out and may not even be available in the States. And in stealing some of this music, I have become electrified by it, and I've become a committed fan of whatever band it happens to be, and I've wound up inevitably buying not only all of their material, but much more profitably to the band itself, tickets to their concerts. And of course, they are making fractions of pennies for your Spotify listen. So in the long run, yeah. I feel like this is, without making a wide sweeping argument, I think it's certainly one of the ways by which I've encountered a lot of the most sort of outer music that I've found.
The thing about Spotify only making people pennies is I think I kind of shut out from listening, finding new music because of this sense of there not really being a good way. Like, I can't spend a ton of money paying for all these albums that I'm curious about, and I can't only listen to it on Spotify. So, I mean, there's a way to split the difference. Like, I've paid for a couple albums recently that I was interested in, and I've, looked up a bunch, like the Taylor Swift album I don't want to pay for on Spotify. But it is hard. Like, we're in this moment where there's so much music out there, but the level to which you're supporting these artists can really vary, and you have to make a lot of choices. There.
Yeah, I think also. Sorry, Dave. Go on.
I want to step in and have some two out of the box things because I don't use Spotify because I think it's a problematic service for everybody. Things everybody are saying. What I used to use is a combination of SoundCloud, which are user-based things, and they just added this reblog feature where if somebody you're following finds a song they like, they could reblog it to your profile, and it'll be like in a news feed. So then you have a whole bunch of remixes or original stuff that will link you to new bands. And then I also do archive.org has everything that's like open to public use, which is now including like all these great like jazz and soul singers and everything from like the 30s and 40s that's now turning over into public domain. I've been having a grand old time over there. I just want to say in terms of like if there's a lot of places to go and find popular music, but I feel like if you're reaching into the areas that like Patches is reaching into, like you kind of have to get off of Spotify because Spotify's there to get you to listen to that new.
Well, I think
album.
You can go back to Spotify to kind of delve into it. I had a realization that I was a huge Ravi Shankar fan when he passed away. I looked at my iTunes and saw that I only owned two albums, but I go to Spotify and I can spend 3 days just listening to Ravi Shankar. And that's the wonder of Spotify for me, that you have to go out and discover using different means. But for Spotify, it's come back and enjoy the breadth of their work.
Yeah, I'm going to continue trying to start listening to music again and hopefully someday have recommendations for you other than, hey, that Alabama Shakes album is really good.
The Knife.
I listened to The Knife 10 years ago. I haven't caught it back up. So, see, I need
well,
your
they
help.
Have a new album coming out, and I am, having fever dreams about it every night.
you are all welcome to give me recommendations, you guys on the show and listeners, so you can help me be culturally well-rounded, which is embarrassing that it's taken me this long. So, yeah, Spotify. I'm enjoying it.
We've scoured the corners of our minds and the internet to bring you a different interpretation, perspective, or retconning of a well-known pop culture touchstone. We all thought we knew the story, but what this segment presupposes is maybe we didn't. Let's play Pop Culture Existential Crisis. So this week we're talking about, we're just going to start kind of easy. This isn't the most, you know, groundbreaking existential crisis thing, but I'm going to ease everybody into it. We're going to talk about the theory that during the three Toy Story movies, Woody the cowboy doll is actually a sub-in for Andy's deceased father. And there's a few things that I point to every time I bring up this pop culture existential crisis. One is that we know from Toy Story 2, Woody's from an old, like, Howdy Doody-esque puppet TV show, which is at least one generation before we join up with Andy, who's playing with the new Buzz Lightyear TV show toy. So that's sort of the idea that, you know, either somebody got it from a garage sale or he was given to Andy by his father, which I enjoy. And then the fact that the father doesn't show up or isn't even mentioned in 3, where even if it was, like, some sort of divorce, you feel like it would be like the dad would make some sort of effort to bring his son to college. So, I mean, there's never any discussion. There is a discussion about Toy Story 2 being a good example of single parenting. I don't know how good that is, since I guess only the toys get put in mortal danger.
But, wait, when you say he's a stand-in for the father, do you mean that in an emotional way only, that he's supposed to remind us that the father figure isn't there and that Andy is dealing with this over the course of the trilogy? Or are you talking literally he is a stand-in for the father like Jack Frost, Michael Keaton, you know, the dead dad inhabits a doll, a cowboy doll, and becomes like Andy's father?
I think that everything Andy imbues him with is stuff that he believes, or the only memories he has with his father, specifically that speech he gives at the end of 3 about how Woody will never give up on you. And it's sort of sad in the sense that he didn't have a father, and so he made this toy he got from his father, you know, into something. There's also a lot of talk in 3 about how Woody is sort of okay with the idea that everybody go up into the attic, which somebody recommended to me online is because that he was in the attic for a period of time before Andy was born.
Oh. And I mean,
the only thing that sort of throws this off is I'm not sure when Andy's little sister goes into the mix, because she's an infant in 1, which would make it seem like Andy's father had,
well,
you know,
she might, the mom could have gotten pregnant and then the dad could have died.
My problem with this entire line of inquiry is that I have never cared much for or been all that interested in Andy as a character, because I've always found the toys to sort of, I mean, it's really sort of this existential struggle between the toys who sort of are representatives and God or lack thereof, and how they sort of find their own way and sort of there's these immortal characters made out of plastic and whatever else that are also coming to grips with their own mortality or their value to these sort of divine forces. And so for me, the adult world, the human world, it's like Charlie Brown. You never really see their faces. You know, it's which is not literally true in this film. But yeah.
But does that mean that is that a flaw of the film? Because they people in the movie that they should be have meatier parts?
It's not a flaw in the film at all for me. It's just this whole line of thought that Dave is, you know, steering us down towards is novel to me, because I had never really cared much for any of the people in this trilogy, which is why maybe at the end of the third film I was completely unmoved, because I think it lands
too
hard
have no heart
on the human side, and I didn't care about any.
You know what
people
would have maybe helped if this theory is true, if this line of thinking had been put into the original Toy Story, if, like, Andy's mom's new boyfriend gave him Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah.
Oh.
That would have been,
I think,
like,
I think that would have been, like, too much of what David was complaining about, too much about the people.
I mean, I think it's close to that, because if you think about the conflict of cowboy versus spaceman, that's inherently a 1960s conflict, which is out of Andy's, you know, realm entirely.
But so you don't think that's because it's in the realm of the animators? Like, that's John Lasseter's world?
I mean, I think it might have started that way, but in terms of thinking it as a complete piece where Woody's somehow both a stand-in and maybe possibly actually, maybe it is kind of more Jack Frosty than I was giving it credit.
It never really made sense that Andy was so infatuated with Woody. Like, why would a contemporary kid would not play with that toy, like an old toy.
Well,
like
I mean, that's part of the argument. It's like you don't bring an old cowboy toy to college as your only toy unless it was the last thing your father gave you. So yeah. I guess we're going to continue thinking about pop culture existential crisis, but that's an example of what we have coming in the future. We're coming after all your beloved properties.
You know, I feel like this segment is over, but I just wanted to say one more thing.
Go ahead.
If it was Andy's dad's – you're saying it's Andy's dad's toy, not Andy's – not a gift from his dad to Andy, right?
I could be either way. I don't think there's any solid contextual evidence.
Unless his dad's name is Andy, I don't understand that theory because the name is
Andy
etched
is written
into
on his
the
shoe.
And
it's true.
No, that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it got painted over in two and then rewritten. So, I mean, that happens.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Andy Jr. They should have just dropped that in.
While you overthinking Pixar nerds.
Sorry.
Oscar season is upon us. In fact, it is almost over. When you're hearing this episode, we are just a couple days away from the Academy Awards on Sunday. And as you might have noticed in hints on earlier episodes of the show, I am a fan of the Oscars, and my co-hosts are to varying degrees not especially big fans. And so they basically challenged me this week to explain why the Oscars matter, and because it was not fair to have a 3-on-1 fight, I brought in some backup in the form of Nathaniel Rogers of The Film Experience, who is also a frequent co-host podcaster of mine. With his podcast, The Film Experience. Nathaniel, thank you so much for joining me for this fight.
Happy to be here. I will use my a fake Oscar as a bludgeon against self-doubt like Anne Hathaway.
So I wanted you to start off because you much more so than me, I think, are really committed to the Oscars. You blog about them almost year-round. I think you take a break once in a while. And you have been a fan of them since a very early age. And I wanted to know both why they've struck a chord with you personally for so long and then why you think they matter and continue to matter.
Well, I mean, a brief history. Like when I was a little kid, my parents are not really into movies. And when I was a little kid, the only thing I knew about the Oscars were this horrible place where Star Wars lost. That was the only thing I ever heard about them. And so
there are many people who still think of them that way.
It's funny because we're about to run a top 50 best picture nominees the top 50 best picture nominees that didn't win the Oscar, and Star Wars did not make the cut for the top 50.
Yeah, and well, when I was little, I agreed with that. I was like, that is horrible. Star Wars is the best, you know? But then I convinced my family to go see Purple Rose of Cairo. So my parents drove me, and I did not know what we were in for at all. I don't even know why. But I left the theater just completely, like, wowed by it. And my family just hated it. And from then on, it was like, oh, that Woody Allen, that awful man who beat Star Wars at the Oscars. But then I like started getting into it and I started like reading magazines. And back then there was no, you know, internet in the mid-80s. So it was like you would wait for the monthly film magazines or whatever, or People magazine, and they would occasionally have like Oscar stuff. So I just became more and more interested. And it really led me, and this is why I think the Oscars are important. It really led me to cinephilia. Like I started renting movies. I started, you know, like researching careers that I
gateway drug.
Right. Exactly. Ah. And so for me, the end justifies the means. However you get to your cinephilia, it's a good thing.
Interesting. Is there something about a contest that does that for you instead of like a list? Like, I mean, recently we talked to my mother about how we used to do the AFI Top 100 list as a family. So is there something that you feel is better? Like, does the Oscars make a better conversation amongst cinephiles? Or is you just need that's your gateway into cinephilia?
They're certainly louder than everything else. I mean, they're out there more. They're apparent.
Well, to me, they are a list. You know, it's because it is just like a collection of things that, you know, in that case, the industry is excited about, you know? Mm-hmm. And so once you can separate that in your mind and realize this is just what the film industry is into at the moment, and view it like a time capsule, it's a great list.
Yeah, I think the time capsule element is the real thing about it that I continue to stick up for. And that it still doesn't explain the engaging with the awards race the way you do, and I want to get back to that. But the notion of here are the 5 or 10 Best Picture nominees, here is what was popular at the time for all the various reasons is still important, even though it can be, you know, you can credit whatever winning. You can credit Shakespeare in Love to Harvey Weinstein and nothing but Harvey Weinstein, but it's still a time capsule from what was happening.
It's also a better film than Saving Private Ryan, but that's neither here nor there. But isn't there a fear that this list, as much as it invites conversation about these particular films, excludes conversation about, I don't know, the hundreds of other movies that come out in a given year and really sort of just rarefies this one stripe of filmmaking?
But how could that not be the case? I mean, at the end of the year, how do you talk about all the hundreds of films that come out in a given year?
Well, but the problem I see potentially, and I won't reveal to the extent that I'm representing Devil's Advocate or not, but the problem is that you have certain people spending 5 months as this interminable Oscar season goes on to talking about the same 10 films, and that, you know, is just a wildly out of whack.
But you're getting into something different here, which is the emergence of people who just cover the Oscars and the fact that the Oscars work for all people in different ways.
But it trickles down, of course. I mean, they're driving the discourse, and while other people are free financially to explore other options in a way that someone like Sasha Stone may not be, they are at the same time sort of at the mercy of this conversation, which is so restrictive. And that can be damaging to other films that, you know, just have no shot of being included.
Well, I mean, hasn't the film community sort of adapted to that, where we get like these doldrums of January and February? So, like, if you have time to think about a movie, here's a list of movies to think about deeply.
Nathaniel, I want to hear from you about the 10 conversation or the limiting conversation thing.
Well, I mean, I do agree that it's a problem. I mean, nothing is perfect, and no system is not going to have its drawbacks. And definitely the release schedule, like the sort of compartmentalization, is really horrible for cinema. And but I don't really know how to combat that. As for, you know, limiting the conversation, that's one of the reasons my site is the film experience rather than the Oscar experience.
You're not the bad guy. It's okay.
Yeah, well, even though I love the Oscars, and I mean, even when I'm talking about old movies, I love to talk about the Oscars, but I also think it's just a part of the picture of cinema. But I figure, like, the auteurism of cinephilia will keep a lot of films in the conversation that don't get any Oscar attention. So the ones I worry about are the sort of one-offs that are really great. And if they didn't get Oscar attention, then they would fade away.
Well, that's a thing. Like the fact that Amour is part of the conversation this year. Seems important and seems like one of the reasons the Oscars can work in the favor of people who might dismiss them, who are talking about all the other films that are coming out in the year.
It feels like a concession to sanity and art.
Well, and maybe we get to
just not a bad thing.
There's something like that happens. I mean, almost every year, there's always some kind of nominate. Like, you know, when Julie Christie was a front runner for Best Actress for Away From Her, which is a tiny Canadian movie that, you know, gave Sarah Polley this amazing director a career. You know, there's things like that slip through.
I mean,
the Oscars go from good to bad. I mean, you have Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close up for Best Picture, and, you know, not whatever from last year didn't get nominated.
Although, of course, there's the risk of a single film in any given Oscar cycle, in this case, Haneke's Amour, becoming sort of a synecdoche of all intelligent-minded art cinema. I mean, you see the same problem in what I find to be the most problematic part of the Oscars as a whole, which is the best foreign picture category, which is, you know, I think for me an easy fix would be a semantic one, which is including the word American in the AMPIS acronym, the American Academy of Motion Pictures, and Sciences, because otherwise you're saying that the best film in any given year since the invention of cinema has been in the English language.
But that's just, I mean, that's remarkable. Just what the Academy is saying with their inherent biases. You know, I think when people really start being driven crazy by the Oscars, it's like, so the world is saying that the best film of 2011 was The Artist? And it's like, no, just this group of, you know, 5,000 people or so is saying it. And we're interested in what they have to say, but we all all write our own top 10 lists. We all know what we think. Right, and we all want to help make people aware that
the rules,
not
the rules of the best foreign picture, I don't think do them any favors in that regard.
Well, I think it's also worth noting that a lot of countries with a healthy cinema of their own have their own version of the Oscars. So they give out, you know, like France has the Goyas. Césars, the Goyas in Spain.
And the Genies.
Baptist. The Genies in Canada.
Hey, so, they're like, French films.
All of those groups have a best foreign film category as well. That
includes- but our films win their awards too, which is the problem with the BAFTAs.
Yes.
Oh, yes. That's plenty of problems.
Yeah, the BAFTAs aren't very patriotic. It's all about the American cinema.
I guess to sort of make a wide analogy here, I sort of feel like paying a lot of attention to the Oscars race is saying you're interested in world politics, but only monitoring the UN. You know, like, being like, I acknowledge that I'm really into film, and I know what I'm talking about, and I'm going to cover this race. And I don't know, it seems like... I'm totally for it being a gateway into the everyday person being able to contextualize what Hollywood sees as like a good period of Hollywood. The question is there too much focus on that would be my question.
On the flip side to what you're saying, Dave, don't you think it's important if you're covering world politics to see the UN activity and relate to it? And if I'm going to talk film, I should at least include how the Oscars are responding to this year's slate of movies and have a conversation about that in some way, even if I personally dismiss their actions. I feel like a lot of people who are against the Oscars are fully against them and will not embrace them as part of their conversation at all, and that might be a problem if I want to talk about pop culture in a serious way.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like... I'm sorry, go ahead, Nathaniel. I think I cut you off.
Well, I just think... Even with world cinema, if you want to talk about cinema as a global art form, which it of course is, even that, how can you possibly, you still need a list to work from. I mean, there's so much, like you could never learn everything about everything. So even with the Oscars as a gateway for foreign film, I mean, I know that keeps me in the loop, even if it's just to rage against them for saying they never notice South Korea or they never nominate Romania, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, and you engage with foreign films a lot more than a lot of other Oscar people do, which is another way that I think you can turn this into an almost year-long activity just by keeping an eye on all of the options and not just what the final 9 or 10 Best Picture nominees are.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, I really hate that they've changed the foreign film. I mean, I think that it's better. We're getting better slates of nominees with their executive committee, but I hate that they've done the finalist thing that reduces it to like 9 movies before we get the nominees, because then suddenly all of those other movies are suddenly nobody talks about them.
Yeah.
Is the contest,
which I think is a real shame, you know?
Especially when some of those films are like Contiki at the expense of, you know, slightly more intriguing offerings.
Is the contest what's screwing us up? Like, I know that's why when I feel animosity towards the Oscars, it's not that they're making a list of good cinema. It's that they're stepping forward and saying that you could, like, buy that sticker on your DVD that makes you sell an extra 20,000 copies.
No, I don't think the contest is a problem. What seems a problem, actually, based on what Nathaniel just said, and is really intriguing to me, is maybe the Oscar nominees are a problem. That if you showed up on the Oscar night and just gave the awards away without any context or build-up...
That'd be so insane.
You'd have to talk about every movie, and there would be no short list, and then things wouldn't narrow down. We'd just be having conversations about all the movies all the time.
But having a nomination, having a nomination has a lot of power. I mean, you see something like John Hawks, who got an Oscar nomination for Winter's Bone, and his career has really taken off since then. Like that, it helps. I think having nominees helps more than it hurts, because you have these people fighting for a nomination, which carries on that conversation for a long time. I mean, we were talking about Moonrise Kingdom for a long time after it came out, because thought it had a chance at a Best Picture nomination. And even though it didn't get it, it still got the benefit of all
that. But it doesn't really help.
Even with foreign films, that helps, though, because think of Almodovar's career. Mm-hmm. Like he was a nominee for Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown back in the 80s, which was his international breakthrough, basically, even though people, you know, were already watching his films. But even when his films don't even come anywhere close to Oscar attention, he's still talked about in that sense. So right. he, get, I mean, he he gets coverage every time, you know?
I feel like one of the problems is that the Oscars don't take themselves as seriously as so many of us do, as the film industry does as a whole. And I think that a lot of the issues that we have with them could be easily corrected by stricter protocols within the organization. I mean, they're never going to make a bid for, you know, being definitive as, you know, objectively saying that this is the best film of a given year. But if they forced every nominee, they're a bit more selective about who they allow into the Academy, first off, and then they forced anyone who actively wanted to participate in the Oscar process to watch all of the films that are eligible, or at least a certain percentage of them, and to vote, you know, to have a very narrow period of voting so that the campaign season could really be cut down, so that you could have the nominees introduced and then voting shortly thereafter, and then you could have months of anticipation leading up to the show if you wanted, but it would so cut down on the poll and push and the so Jeff Wells's and
it's the People's Choice Awards with a really restrictive judging basis is what you're saying.
No, what I'm saying is that they were the Oscars would benefit from being much more restrictive in how they allow people to vote. I mean, I think that it's their stab of credibility, any stab of credibility is sort of removed by the fact that they have these 5,000 members or whatever it is, and you know, as it's repeated year in and year out, that so many of them haven't seen any of the movies, and they are contributing to the most prestigious, if not the most exciting, award in all of film. And I think that if the Oscars are going to continue to have that reputation, they need to earn it. I mean, they need to really they do it. It's in their power to make the award mean something.
I absolutely agree with that, and I've long argued that they should, in any category that they want to vote in, they should have to see every nominee.
Yeah,
which is true of a couple categories, but it's unfortunately not true overall.
Mm. Yeah, the inconsistencies in the categories and the way that you get stuff like the best song or the best score branch being notoriously biased for one or another. Like, there's, I mean, but that's something that you can, that I tend to embrace as just kind of part of the process. Like, it's an award voted on by a group of people, like anything else, and there's going to be weird problems like that that crop up.
Yeah. I mean, do people do themselves a service to consider? Is there a way to embrace the Oscars that you would recommend to make them function as something for people who love movies as opposed to, I mean, they feel like a sporting event. And I don't, is that healthy? Is that a good thing for people who love movies?
There, I'm not sure it is. Like, I've been a little surprised over the years of my blogging that you'll sometimes be talking to readers or whatever that, you know, are really into the Oscars, and you'll mention something, and they'll, after a big long conversation, they'll be like, well, I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
You know, I've just been watching the clips online, and I was like, oh, no, that's not the same thing as seeing a movie.
Well, you also get people who, I mean, and Nathaniel, I think your commenters, they are super passionate, and they get a lot of like, well, I hate Meryl Streep this year because she might be Viola Davis for Best Actress. And it's like, it becomes this weird, it forces some people into this thinking of a zero-sum game where either one movie wins and everything else loses, and there's no way to love both. But I think a healthy appreciation for the Oscars can help avoid that.
What about...
Well, but I mean, also the Oscars don't help with that either, because they so often, like, once they're, you know, love something, that's what they love, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I guess as a way of wrapping up, as somebody who is vocally against the Oscars as an award ceremony, how can I approach your guys' coverage from a positive standpoint?
Of the awards ceremony or the season?
I don't like the awards ceremony. I'm open to discussing films, but it's like, as soon as I see, like, Oscar rundown, my eyes start glazing over because I keep thinking it's going to be like a EW odds post.
Well, I mean, the ceremony itself is the sporting event. You know, it's not, you're never going to get your most interesting discourse from the actual ceremony, but I do think there's a lot of interesting stuff that happens in the ceremony. Like, I love, like, acceptance speeches, like figuring out, you know, what people value. I think what comes out on that night is actually what they feel, even if it feels rehearsed or even if it feels spazzy. So I think that's an interesting thing. Like, take Nicole Kidman's speech for The Hours, you know, like, she immediately started talking about how the importance of art.
Biased toward Nicole Kidman or anything.
No, but it was a very telling thing, because it was a really awkward segue, and it, like, her speech didn't go over that spectacularly. This was back in, you know, 2000, February 2003 or whatever.
Yeah.
And but I mean, I think it was telling because like she is more artistically ambitious. So I love looking for the like the hints of what people are actually like as artists in their sort of public persona.
Yeah, the show is bizarre. It's insane. And it's one night where we get to goof off and
right.
kind of.
It's always too long and it's always going to be kind of boring. And
but that's
always,
why I like but it. That's, like,
exactly.
that's why I enjoy it.
It is what it is. Yeah.
Well, it's extremely bizarre and has nothing to do with the conversation about movies. And I'm fine with that. It's an excuse to get all these people in one place and do something awful and weird and bizarre.
And don't you guys always love to see what the costume designers actually wear themselves?
Or what they look like.
Right.
They always look slightly crazy.
This is the first time all the editors have finally come out of a dark room. And
I'll have to self-censor my Aiko Ishioka joke. But I do hope she wins.
I do
she
too.
Has a chance, maybe.
All right. I think that if you were doubtful about the Oscars, I hope this gives you some interesting context to watch the Sunday show. And Nathaniel, thank you so much for jumping into this lion's den and not getting eaten alive.
Oh, yeah. It was fun.
Where can I go read more of your stuff, Nathaniel?
At thefilmexperience.net.
You are the best Oscar writer of 2013.
Do you have your acceptance speech prepared?
I do. It's as simple as thank you.
Oh.
Perfect.
That's like Audrey Hepburn. Two words and she was done.
It's the way to go.
That does it for this week's Operation Kino. We'll be back at the end of this week with a review of Snitch. And again, next week with an episode about everything that is not the Oscars. It will be over and we won't have to talk about it for a whole nother year.
Sure.
Congratulations. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I'm the movies editor of Hollywood.com. Find me on Twitter at Mr. M-I-S-T-E-R Patches. And also remember, we are reading your lightning round answers at the end of the review this week. So hop on Twitter at OpKino. And tell us your answers.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film editor for film.com. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich at film.com and at Criterion Corner. And we'd love to hear from you on our iTunes page where you could drop us a review, especially if you like the show. It's incredibly helpful for us in finding new listeners and improving the show overall.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell that first part D-A-7-E. I am he of UGO.com, where I make some videos. You should also check out us, Operation Kino, on Facebook at facebook.com/opkino, where I will not be cursing for your enjoyment.
For now. And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me here at Cinema Blend or on Twitter at Katie Rich. And you can also call us and leave us a message on our Skype account. The number is 914-410-6450. And we'll be back talking to you next week, or next week and Friday. In the morning, I'm 1,000 pieces of glass. If he stays, then I'll wait for him. In the morning, I'm 1,000 pieces of glass. If he stays, I'll wait for him. In the morning, I'm 1,000 pieces of glass. If he stays, then I'll wait for him. In the morning, I'm 1,000 pieces of light.